My name is Blanche, and I'm a member of a worldwide fellowship known as Al-Anon. Hi. I have been a member of the Al-Anon family groups since July 7th, 1964, but I have been addicted to mood-changing, mind-altering men ever since I can remember. Oh, a little identification out there. These 29 years make me a survivor, not a savior, and I say that to remind myself of it on a regular basis because I am one person away from an obsession at all times. I'm really delighted to be here. It's an honor to be asked to share Al-Anon anywhere. Last month I was in Taos, New Mexico, and they were wearing buttons that said, a conference is like an orgy. When it's over, you don't know who made you feel good. I almost didn't tell you that, but I decided I could. It's always fun to be in on beginnings. I love being at the first of anything because I feel proprietary about it after that. You know, I share with you for an hour and it's my convention from then on. And it was great fun to be in on the beginning of this one. I have managed to come back once in the 10 years since. A close friend of mine was speaking and my now husband and I drove over to be with you and to hear him. And I had a great time that weekend too. So many people to thank. Jerry and Claudia for picking me up at the airport and getting me here. And Candy for hostessing. Thanks a lot for choosing someone young and beautiful. That's all I needed this weekend. I have always loved Louisiana, and I've made many talks around the state. But I've talked about you all and this convention ever since I was first here. I really have. I'm a very stodgy person. I just miss being a stick in the mud. And you loosen me up when I'm here. And I got here yesterday tired and cranky. And I've been under a great deal of stress. And I have been soothed and welcomed and loved with that unconditional love that I first found at my very first meeting. Much of my story is the same. I don't know how to change it. I can't go back and redo any of it. But there have been some events since I last shared with you, so I'm glad to have a chance to bring you up to date. I have been trying for a long time when I give Al-Anon talks anywhere to be as open and as honest as I know how to be. Because that which does not come from the heart does not reach the heart, and I very much want to reach your hearts this afternoon, and that means I need to talk to you from mine. See, it would be easier for me to tell you what I think than how I feel. And it would be easier for me to lecture on the principles of the program than it would be to talk about me. But that's not what it's about. And so since you taught me that I can ask for what I need is for you to love me back, please, while I'm talking, because I'm emotionally naked up here, you know, and I'm very vulnerable. I came here to participate in your weekend and not to perform. And I would rather you leave thinking what a great program than what a great speaker. I do, by the way, always have a few notes in front of me. If you have a problem with that, I suggest you call your sponsor and talk about acceptance. Of course, I know God can tell me what to say, but he isn't limited to doing that the minute I get on the podium. I've known for 3 years that I would be here this weekend. It'd be pretty sad if I hadn't thought of what I want to say to you. I came into Al-Anon kicking, screaming, clutching my halo, wrapping my robes of righteousness about me, protesting to everyone who would listen and a lot of people who didn't care that I was fine, thank you. And if we just had sobriety at our house, everything would be fine. See, I can't say that with a straight face now, but I believed it then. I've always been so grateful that God led me to a group of people who were serious about recovery, who practiced their programs. What I know of Al-Anon principles today, I know not because someone read them to me or recited them to me, but because they were practiced lovingly and tenderly on me. These were people who loved me when I was unlovable, who forgave my behavior when it was condescending and patronizing and pretty well unforgivable. I learned right away what we are not, that we were not a ladies auxiliary and not a stitch and bitch club and not a coffee clatch. And I have taken to saying this whenever I talk. I don't know whether you have this problem in Louisiana, but we do in Texas. There are well-meaning members of AA who sometimes refer to any non-alcoholic in their families as an Al-Anon. That's like referring to a still-drinking alcoholic as a member of AA. An Al-Anon is a member of an Al-Anon family group and attends meetings and studies the literature and has a sponsor and works the steps and does a great deal of service. And if you hear anyone else talking about Al-Anon, don't listen. Those people are uninformed. They are not carrying the message. They are spreading the disease. Well, anyway, back to what we are not. I learned we were not cookie bakers and coffee makers. And above all, we are not AA groupies. And we've never purported to be a therapeutic tool for the treatment of alcoholism. Al-Anon doesn't promise to save marriages, only sanity. And I thought both of those were in fine shape when I got to you, but I live to learn better than that. Happily ever after may not mean walking hand in hand into the sunset together. Happily ever after means my personal recovery. And so I have a success story to share with you this afternoon because this program is for me. And for those of you in AA, let me say with as much gentleness and love as I can, Al-Anon is not the enemy. We are the ones who loved you when you were not at your most lovable, who have found you irresistible and charming, and who have believed your promises. And I think we could rejoice in our recovery together, and that's what I would like to stress today. An analogy I always use about my beginning in Al-Anon is my mother's illness and death. She was in Florida, I was in Texas. She died at 58, which isn't young, but it's young to die. I absolutely adored her, and I thought I could not stand it. When I was making my last visit with her, a woman in the room across the hall, whom I've never seen before or since, I don't know how she knew who I was, she beckoned me into her room, and I stepped over there, and she said, "Your mother's going to be all right." And I said, "Oh, you don't understand. Her illness is terminal." And this woman said, "I didn't say she would get well. I said she would be all right." And my mother did not get well, and she has been all right ever since. Now, it's very much as if, when I got to you, as if you had said to me, "You will be all right." And if you had, I would have said, "Oh, you don't understand. I have a barely sober husband." And you would have said, "We didn't say anything about a sober husband. We said you would be all right." Or I would have said, "I have a very fragile, shaky marriage." And you would have said, "Oh, we didn't promise you a marriage. We said you would be all right." Because at some level, that's what I heard. And I have been, you know. And better than that, I know I will be, because everything you've told me so far has been true. Well, our literature tells us how to make an Al-Anon talk. I'm going to memorize this in a year now, but I haven't yet. It says Al-Anon talks can be, and too often are, merely a repetition of past and present sorrows. Now, sketching the background is important and has its place, but it's merely the foundation of the talk. The best Al-Anon talk, the one that helps the most people to the highest degree, is the one that brings out just how the program works and just how the speaker follows it. A good Al-Anon talk is divided into three parts: how sick I was, how well I am, and what helped me to get well. Of these three, the emphasis should be on what helped me to get well. So I hope I can spend the minutes I have with you stressing primarily what has helped me to get well. I agree with Father Martin, who always says that when he's sitting out there and you're up here, he says, "You're playing with my life. Don't tell me how sick you were without telling me how well you are." I was born on Christmas Day on my grandmother's farm in northeast Florida, just below the Georgia border, in the year of our Lord. Well, actually, I no longer say which one. I have reached the point where I not only lie about my age, but I forget what I said that it was, you know. I will just tell you that I'm somewhere between Blue Lagoon and on Golden Pond. Or for those of you in education, I'm not old, I'm chronologically challenged. We were not tourists in Florida. My family had been there four generations when I was born. In fact, tourist was a bad word. If I behaved in the manner my mother considered inappropriate, she would say, "Don't act like a tourist." And there are still things I cannot wear and things I cannot do, because that's what tourists did. And I got a thoroughly programmed in that. I have grandnieces who are now in their seventh generation of Florida people. Only my brother and I have left the state, and when I go to family reunions, they still say, "Why don't you come on home now?" You know. Our early years, mine, were in Jacksonville, which is almost on the Georgia border and is on the Atlantic. We lived there until I was 10, and then we moved to Pensacola, which is on the Alabama border and on the Gulf. I think of Pensacola as my hometown, because that's where we lived the longest. And that's where I went back to all those years, you know, that you go back and take the children to see the grandparents. It was then a marvelous place to grow up. It had not been discovered, and there were not condominiums and hotels, and I could just cry when I go back. I don't see that as progress. But when we were living in Jacksonville, my father was charming and intelligent and talented and sensitive. I don't know an alcoholic who isn't. But he was very alcoholic and violent. I was not, thank God, ever sexually abused, but I was a very badly battered child. And you know, it was years before I could say that at a microphone, and it needs saying. It is not that uncommon in an alcoholic home. And let me say quickly that it's not always the alcoholic who does the battering. It just happened to be that way in my house. We lived in abject and grinding poverty. Now, I don't mean there were no luxuries. I mean we went for days on end with no food. I meant there was inadequate clothing, and we lived in a very blighted area of Jacksonville. I have to make that point to say that even where we lived, the neighborhood children were not allowed to play with me. I understand today that their parents were apprehensive about what was going on at my house, but I didn't understand that then. I just felt rejection and rage. And at the age of 5 or 6, you can't verbalize these things, but I know that my thinking was, I'll get back at them some way, somehow. Well, we all went to the same neighborhood school, and I beat the socks off every one of them, and I loved it. I absolutely relished it. Don't let them tell you revenge is not sweet. It was wonderful. Now, my motives were not good, but there was a very good byproduct. I absolutely fell in love with learning, and I've never fallen out of love with it. It has made my life infinitely richer and more exciting. My parents divorced when I was 8. My mother remarried 2 years later, a man that, as it happened, didn't drink at all. We were not close, he and I, but we both loved my mother, and there was a very warm bond between us. We had no luxuries then, but the necessities were there. College was considered a luxury. And when I decided I wanted to go to Baylor, that's how I got to Texas, my mother said, "Well, it's all right, but there are a few things you need to understand. One of them is that you'll have to pay for it yourself." Well, of course, I knew that. It was then and still is a very expensive private university. And she said, "You'll probably spend the rest of your life out there, because you'll end up marrying a Texan and they don't transplant," she said. And I told her, of course, I was going to do no such thing, but I did and they don't, and I have, and so what can I tell you? Now listen, you're just next door, so you know that Texas is a state of mind. They have never forgotten that they were a nation, and that's the kind of pride that they feel. For the last 10 years, until just a few months ago, I was a counselor in a little country school where I had kindergarten through 12th grade. That sounds like a lot, but there were just 500 kids all told there. And in the elementary school, as in many elementary schools in Texas, in the mornings when they pledged allegiance to the American flag, they then turned and pledged allegiance to the Texas flag. Different words, I could recite them to you, but I won't. My point is, I hope you love where you live, because we love where we live there, for sure. My father-in-law, a very ardent Texan, I don't know any other kind, told me that he brought up his children never to ask a man where he was from, because he said, if he's from Texas, he'll tell you, and if he's not, it's not nice to embarrass him. Do you believe that? At the moment, we have both a governor and a lieutenant governor who are, by their own admission, recovering alcoholics. My husband says that makes everyone in the state of Texas eligible for Al-Anon. I know now that it was inevitable that I marry an alcoholic, but I didn't know that then. And I want you to know that I tried not to. I didn't want to suffer as I had seen my mother suffer. And so it seemed to me that if I never dated anyone who drank, I would not run the risk of marrying an alcoholic. And I had never seen Charles take a drink when we married. I'm not sure he had. And we were blindsided by alcoholism. I think about it now. We had matching neuroses, you know? And we nourished them in each other for a very long time. You told me later when I got to you that drinking is only a symptom of alcoholism. And that symptom had not yet manifested in him, as if he had had tuberculosis and he had not yet started hemorrhaging. Does that make sense to you? It wasn't that the illness wasn't there. It was just that not all the symptoms had yet become evident. I know now that sick people marry sick people, and they rear sick children, and I hope you won't let anyone tell you anything different. We lived in Corpus Christi a year, and then in San Antonio for 4 years. Our babies were born there. It's the most beautiful city in Texas and the most charming. And then we moved out to West Texas to my husband's hometown, Odessa. It was named for the city in Russia, but the one in Russia is a seaport, and I promise you the one in Texas is not. The landscape is somewhat like that of the moon. My mother used to call it Odessa, but not where anyone could hear her. I never learned to like the barrenness nor the sandstorms, but I loved those people. I don't know what there is about West Texas people. What I think is that anyone who lives in a very inhospitable climate has to have a kind of a sturdiness and a spirit that the rest of us just don't have. They never knew there was anything they couldn't do, so they did it, you know. I have missed them a lot since I moved away. I'm not sure when the very casual social drinking that Charles did became alcoholic. I just know that it did, and I didn't see it coming. And for a long time, I lived by slogans. Well, before you gave me better ones, wonder if any of you had these. One of them was, what will people think? Did you have that one? How about, don't rock the boat. Don't bring up anything that will cause a problem. It's not that bad yet. Did you have that one? Did you ever play Guess What I'm Mad About? Charles used to say I could ask him a question, answer it myself, and go away mad. I did all the wrong things during those drinking years, and I kept on doing them. I had a cleaning woman who loved football, as does everyone in Texas. That is such an understatement. It is second only to oxygen in importance in Texas. Today is the Texas OU game and the Baylor SMU game, and I have a great deal of interest in both of those. She used to watch football games while she ironed, this woman, and she never quite caught on to instant replay. And she would say, maybe this time he'll catch it. And I would look at her and think, that's what I was like. You know, it didn't work before, but hey, maybe this time it will work. And I kept trying to force solutions. I protected him and I rescued him and I lied about him. And he was almost literally loved to death. And that can happen. I was as obsessed with him as he was compelled to drink. I would like you to think that I stayed with him during these years out of love and loyalty. I did not, and when I'm here, for heaven's sake, I don't have to explain Deep South upbringing. Now, you must understand that Florida is, well, the northern part is southern, and the southern part is northern. And at least in my generation, I might as well have been in Georgia and Alabama because we were just an extension of those states. And Southern women back then, I don't know what it's like now, were given a very specific and definite kind of upbringing. We were made of steel and we could cope. Yes, you flutter your eyelashes and you flash your dimples and you swish your skirts. But it's understood that you're like Scarlett O'Hara in the sweet potato field, you know? I'll never be hungry again. That kind of coping. We were called Steel Magnolias long before it became a play and a movie. I don't know if you still do this in this part of the South, but some of my upbringing might amuse you. I was taught that if you keep the men happy, everything else falls into place. Well, now, there's no argument with that, except no one added, it's up to you to see that your needs are met. It's no one's assignment to make you happy, and nobody added that. I was taught by precept and example, you know, Blanche Marie, repeat after me, that we were ladies in the parlor, wizards in the kitchen, hussies in the bedroom. Nothing wrong with that. Except no one said, as I wish they had, that you don't give up big chunks of your own personhood for that. And so I'm not sorry for any of that, but it did keep me a little phony for a very long time because you didn't live with the man and criticize him to other people, and you didn't air your linen in public. So my solution was to try harder, and I had this drive to fix it. I also had no tolerance or understanding. How could I? My thinking was that I had had a very inauspicious beginning myself. I had paid my way through a very fine, expensive university. I married the man I wanted. I had children when I wanted them. And I had a career that I loved and which I did well. And I figured anyone who started out as I did and managed, well, anybody could. I know now how self-righteous that sounds, but I didn't know that for a long time. It required my sponsor to make me say over and over, we are not morally superior to sick people, because I had no tolerance for nor understanding of people who messed up their lives. I did a few things right, though, even during the worst of those times. I never called Charles a drunk. I never thought of him that way. I was married to a very fine man who drank too much. And I knew at some level that he was sick. Now, back then, no one knew it was an illness per se. But I knew he wouldn't be that way because he wanted to be. And I had a God then whom I worshipped and served, not God as I understand him today. If I live another 30 years, I hope my understanding of God will have deepened and broadened as it has since I've been with you. And I had a doctor who was Al-Anon before I got to you, and I say that because this is the man who said a few things to me that you said later. One was, you have to do what's necessary for your own sanity and serenity regardless. And he finally gave me a prescription. He knew just which word to use, by the way. He said, your children need one stable parent. And need was the operative word. If you need me, I'm putty in your hands. On the prescription, he wrote that I should return to teaching. I had taught school before my children were born, but I'm very grateful that I was able to stay home with them for, gosh, it was 12 years, I guess. I am not spontaneous. I wish I were. I have worked my way up to flexible, but I'll never make frivolous. And so I had to think about this for a while. It was a year, in fact. And I did return to teaching. I taught English in a very fine, very affluent high school, very large. I miss it more than anything else in West Texas since I left. I was so glad to hear Willie again last night. Every time we talk at the same convention, I'm pleased to hear her tell you how much she loved teaching because I loved it. I miss it so much. Later on, I became a school counselor, and I would slip into the English classes until I realized I had so much trouble keeping my mouth shut, I had better not do that anymore. I mean, they weren't doing it right. You know how it goes, don't you? I taught during, oh gosh, when I retired, I had 30 years, so I'm not sure how many were where, and I retired in January. I don't want you to think it was one long honeymoon with teenagers now. There were days when I wished for retroactive birth control, but not usually. Charles never stopped trying to find an answer, and I respected him then, and I still do for that. He went to doctors. We didn't suspect alcoholism. I mean, he drank at home. I had never been around closely an alcoholic except my father, and that was the only one I had to go by. And Charles was never violent, and he never went to bars. He just drank at home until he passed out. He used to say he never had any fun drinking, and that if, God forbid, he did it again, he'd know how to do it the second go-round. But he certainly didn't have any fun with it. It was strictly for oblivion. Someone suggested to him that he talk to a counselor who, in Odessa at that time, a psychologist who was doing family counseling. Now, he wasn't willing to go to counselors as a general rule, but he went to this one, and it was she who sent us to you. In fact, in January of 1964, I was home from school still for the Christmas holidays. I'm sure there are moments in your life that are so graced and so lucid that you remember every detail. I remember the carpets and the drapery, you know, everything about it. She told me who she was. I recognized her name, of course. She said, "Your husband is an alcoholic. This is a family disease, and I need to talk to you, too." And all of my Deep South upbringing went out the window, and I said, "You're out of your mind," and hung up. Now, I was not brought up to behave that way. I was taught that if you have a problem with someone, you are kind but cool. And I was not either of those words in any of their meanings. But before I could leave the room, the phone rang again, and when I picked it up before I could say hello, she said, "Don't hang up." She said, "I know what you've been through." Well, nobody could know. I hadn't told anybody. And I stood there with that phone in my hand. You see, I thought all the tears had long since been shed. But I cried and I cried and I cried. That was your first gift to me before I even got to you. I cry anytime I please now. Charles used to say I could cry reading a telephone directory or a menu. No, but supermarket openings are rather touching, don't you? Actually, it's television commercials that get me. The Kodak ones, oh, tear my heart out. But I stood there crying, and we did go to see her, and it was she who sent us to you. And for 6 months, I would go only to open AA meetings, and if anyone had the questionable judgment to invite me to Al-Anon, I was kind but cool. And I explained that I had not done the drinking, and I did not need the therapy, thank you very much. Oh, gosh, they were wonderful. I think about it now. I think how irritated I am when someone acts the way I did. And, of course, God sends me people like that on a regular basis. In July of that year, we went back to San Antonio. I told you we had loved living there. We went for the 4th of July weekend, and Charles got drunk. Now, he always said, "I must tell you it was not a slip, that it was a carefully planned drunk. It was not the longest one nor the worst one, and I know now that I was not surprised. I didn't expect him to stop drinking." Don't you know that attitude helped him a lot? We were going home, and to this man's credit, he never drove drunk or hungover. And we were driving home, and I was driving, and he said, "I've got to tell my group about this. I'm due to get a 6-month chip next week. Do your groups give little mementos of sobriety?" And in my appalling ignorance, I said, "Oh, I won't tell anybody." And he had to tell me that wasn't the name of the game. And I have to tell you that to say this is the first time we've been married 14 years. This man had never once said to me, "I'm sorry, I made a mistake, I was wrong." And he was going to go down there and say it to some people he had known 6 months. And it made me mad. I wanted to be the one to get him sober. Then he would have owed it all to the love of a good woman. And he would have been grateful to me the rest of his life. And you may be sure I would have seen to it that he was. So I went back to take a second look at these people who had such a hold on him. And I used to get this far in my story, and I would say, "Now, I don't know why the invitation to attend Al-Anon reached me at that point when it had not before. I have, in these almost 30 years, done 3, I think, very thorough and comprehensive 4th and 5th steps. And with the very first one, God revealed to me far more than I was interested in knowing about myself. And one of the bits of insight was how I could hear her. And rigorous honesty requires that I tell you, and I wish I didn't have to. This is a woman that I thought was as good as I was. I mean, what can I tell you? You know, it takes what it takes. She had everything I considered important. She had money and prestige and status and breeding and beauty and brains and education. She still has everything I consider important. It's just a very different list today. We have a pamphlet in our Al-Anon literature entitled Living with Sobriety that says, while sobriety can be a welcome miracle, it does not guarantee happiness. Charles was stark, raving sober, very much aware of all of my defects of character. He was no longer held back by guilt from mentioning them loudly and clearly and frequently. And we had a very stormy and very difficult sobriety. When the alcohol is gone, the ism remains. The alcohol is a symptom. And this was the illness from which he was trying to recover. And I had this overlay of fantasy. We are a normal family. We are all right. That was just as hard for me to give up. I have to tell you that I married considerably above myself. He used to say I shouldn't say that. I don't know any other way to say it. I married into a fine old family that at one time had a great deal of money and still had a lot of prestige. And listen, there was nobody not allowed to play with me anymore. And that was so important to me. And I was afraid that if I went down to that building with those people, I would lose all of that. I mean, I've been praying for help, but I thought God was showing very poor taste. This wasn't at all what I had in mind. And of course, I did not know what bad shape I was in. I was so emotionally frozen. During the years that he drank, now I couldn't have told you this, okay? But it's as if I had thought, I can't bear this pain. Watching someone you love with every cell of your being kill himself, I'll match that pain against any there is. And so it's as if I thought, I'll turn off the valve marked anger. I'll turn off the valve marked resentment, the one marked self-pity. And what I didn't know is that there's one valve, and it's marked feelings. And I had turned it off, and I really got to you emotionally shut down, emotionally frozen, and you really did love me back to life. Everyone gets to the program, I think, with walls, defensive walls built around him. It's as if we come into Al-Anon with a suit of armor and a sword, because we're going to protect ourselves and, I mean, a shield in order to protect ourselves and a sword because we still have so much hostility. I used to batter at people's walls, you know, let me in. I want to be your friend. I have decided that's kind of an emotional rape. I don't do that anymore. I believe today that if someone looks out from the chink in his armor and we are warm and loving enough, eventually he will feel safe enough to put down his sword, and in time, perhaps, even his shield. At least that's the way it happened with me. And I began to hear the program not all at once and not just from one person. I have to tell you that alcoholism was not trendy in 1964. It was not the end thing to be alcoholic. Insurance didn't pay for any treatment. There were not treatment centers on every corner. There were not announcements every 30 minutes on television, and celebrities did not announce that they were alcoholics. There was a terrible stigma attached. And nobody knew the whole family was sick, too. I had a hard time coming around to believing that. I mentioned having been a counselor in this little school, talking to a first grade boy one day. I was taking him back to class, and he said, my teacher's not here today. And I said, yes, I noticed. And he said, she's sick. I said, yeah. He said, they sent another teacher. And I said, yes, they did. And he said, when I'm sick, they don't send another little boy. And I thought, oh, honey, the times you'll wish you could send a substitute. Well, I tried to explain to him that no one could learn for him. I thought that when I got to you, no other sick Al-Anon could recover for me either. You know, that was up to me. And my sponsor used to say, you have to understand that you're sick. If you don't, you will not inconvenience yourself to get well. And she said, it is inconvenient to do what we're going to ask you to do. My group used to say that we don't hear the answer until we've asked the question. And if you get there knowing everything, as I did, then you don't ask any questions. You can't teach somebody who already knows it all. And so she would say to me gently and lovingly, you can't put new wine in old bottles, she said. God can only fill an empty vessel, she said. And she suggested that maybe I had to unlearn a few things before I could hear what was going on. I have been taught, and you have too, by well-meaning people, some things that are just not true. A few of them. I don't have time to mention many. One is that God helps those who help themselves. Did you get that one? He does not, you know. He helps those who ask. And the times I've needed him most desperately, I could not have helped myself. If my life had depended on it, and it very nearly did, God helps those who ask. And I was brought up, oh, I learned this one well. Mature people stand on their own two feet, solve their own problems. Did you get that one? It's a sign of weakness to ask for help. I had a hard time unlearning that one. It was explained to me over and over that babies are dependent. They will die if we don't take care of them. Adolescents are independent. I'll do it myself. And that's a phase they have to go through if they're going to grow up. But mature adults are very happily interdependent. And I am not talking about a sick, clinging neediness, okay? I am talking about a very sane, logical appreciation of the fact that we need each other because God works through people. And unless you hear voices and see visions, I don't. I have to pay attention to the people in my life, and I have to let them help me because that's how God works. I did learn that. You see my long-distance charges, you would know that I've learned to holler help. Now, some pain is necessary for my spiritual education, but misery is optional. I do not opt to be miserable today. I have friends in California who are still awake if I can't make it through the night in Texas, and they always tell me I only love them for their time zone. If California is asleep, Hawaii is awake. There are people who care about me and whom I can holler, ouch, and they will talk to me at any hour of the day or night. I have learned to ask for help. I have learned that I have not only a right to, but a responsibility for taking care of myself emotionally. Some pain can be avoided. I no longer have to die on every cross, and I didn't know that till you told me so. I had been brought up to put everyone else first. Did you get that one? And my sponsor suggested that maybe I could unlearn that one in my own best interests. She kept saying, now, I don't mean me first, but I mean my turn. And I'm able today most of the time to say it's my turn when it is. This first sponsor moved halfway across the country after 11 years, and I got another one. And if I had a second hour to talk to you, I would talk to you about sponsorship. I don't understand the kind of ego that undertakes what should be a marvelous spiritual adventure, unguided and undirected. The sponsor I have now always insists that I tell you her name because she does not consider this the public level. Her name is Donna Lancaster, and she lives in Dallas. And she's been in Al-Anon longer than I have. She was born with no legs. It's very hard for me to explain to her that life is unfair to me. As you can imagine, she just sits there and looks at me. She's a remarkable lady. She talks all over the United States and Canada, flies her own plane, does everything I can do and a great many things I cannot. And she has told me all these years, and let's see, we got together in 1977, I guess. She has said, if anything new or challenging or difficult comes into my life, there are two questions I must ask myself. And the first one is, what is in my best interest? Now, you can't do that and be a martyr. And I had so enjoyed being a martyr. I had suffered so nobly, you know, nobly, all those years. I have a friend who says it required plastic surgery to remove her hand from her forehead when she got into Al-Anon. But the second question, I started to say, is even more important. I don't know. And it is, what will enable me to like myself later? She says repeatedly to me, you don't have to like any situation. But she says that it is just imperative that you like yourself in it. And that has changed so many events in my life. It got me through a very painful divorce some years ago. I would not today change one word I said or one thing I did. You know how good that feels? And I couldn't have done that without you. I was brought up being taught what you don't know won't hurt you. What I didn't know nearly destroyed four people. What you don't know can kill you. And so one item at a time, incident by incident, through blood and sweat and tears, I began to let go of what I had been taught so that I could hear you. And I think what kicked in was this love of learning, because I really fell in love with Al-Anon too. I didn't want to settle for a spiritual band-aid. You know, when the immediate pain is eased, you sit home and watch television, no? And I didn't have to be told stick with the winners, because I am attracted to other people that are greedy for recovery and greedy for the program. You began to teach me a few spiritual laws, and they're far more difficult and exacting than the man-made laws I had followed so rigorously all my life. There's a lot of those too, but I have time to I want to mention one. From you, I learned that the worst immorality is judgment. It's my most glaring defect. I don't know whether God has not seen fit to remove it or I have not been willing. Which do you think? And I can tell you what slows me down on being judgmental today. And that is knowing that if I am too judgmental, God will give me that very situation to handle, and sooner rather than later. So I hear myself now when I'm saying, well, I would never, I will. And it scares me to death. Or if I am saying, well, I never treated, I will. And I don't know whether he works in your life like that, but when I ask him to remove a defect, I can't tell him the process by which to do it. And I would far rather he have used some other process than giving me those situations that I was so judgmental about. Of course, I was told to release Charles with love. Basic Al-Anon teaching. Actually, my group said, if you don't like the warts, let go of the frog. I didn't like the warts. I didn't like the person I had become. I am not basically a bitch or a shrew, and I had become both of those. I was a barracuda. Now, releasing is not easy, even after all these decades. Sometimes I have to withdraw emotionally for a while before I can let go. Sometimes I release with anger until I can with love. And everything I've ever released in my life has claw marks all over it, but I'm better at it than I used to be. You told me God could work directly through my husband and children and those I sponsor. I didn't know that. I thought he had to come through me. That's a real symptom of untreated Al-Anonism, is to rush in and rescue, you know. Today, most of the time, I can listen to your feelings without trying to fix you. Most of the time, I bite my tongue and I sit on my hands, but I can do it because you said we don't give advice. And Al-Anon literature stresses that over and over, and I thought, how can you help anybody? And what I found out that we can do best for each other, we can help each other see what our available options are. When I got to you, I thought I had three options. I could divorce this man. I could live with him while we both tried to recover in our respective programs. Or I could have a close, warm, loving, communicative marriage. Unfortunately, I opted for number three, and that was not one of my available options. I hope it is one of yours. But it was not for me. And to this day, any time I am miserable, I have opted for something that is not an available option. So what you do is help me see what my options are, and just as importantly, what they are not. I quit translating. Did you ever translate? Now, honey, what your daddy meant was, sure you did. My kids were in the program. I have a son and daughter, and they were in Alateen for 10 years each. They went in when we had a preteen group. They did a great deal of speaking for Alateen. They served on conference committees. Let me say this. If you gave me half a chance, I would tell you how their father had damaged them. And I had a group that made me look at how I had damaged them. And I thought I couldn't tolerate that. See, I would have died for them in a minute, as you would your children. And to think I had hurt them so much was very difficult for me to accept. I have time to mention only two ways, but this will give you an idea. They were damaged because the first 10 years of their lives, they were programmed by an enraged mother. I would change that if I could. I cannot. And I have been told that I will not recover unless I learn not only to accept the woman I used to be, but to love her. She did the best she could at her level of enlightenment. But I think worse than that was the denial. My children are brilliant and sensitive and intuitive, as yours are. And when they were little, they would ask questions. And they turned to this woman to whom they should have been able to turn for the truth under any circumstances. And they would get lies. For instance, Why, darling, you didn't hear that last night. You must have had a bad dream. Why, no, there's nothing wrong. What makes you think there's anything wrong? And I will submit to you that children to whom that happens grow up doubting their judgment, doubting their reason, doubting their feelings. And they grow up thinking that people you love will lie to you. So I think there will be a special place in heaven. When I'm in California, I say an especially beneficial karma for Alateen sponsors. God bless you, bless you, bless you. You help undo some of the God-awful damage that we have done to them. I began to get my responsibilities straight. You told me I wasn't responsible for his drinking. I was so relieved. I thought I was. He always said I was, and I believed him. But before I could get too smug, you said, on the other hand, you're entirely responsible for your own behavior. Now, I didn't want to hear that. See, next to an alcoholic, anybody looks good. And I had, for any behavior of mine, I had this built-in whipping boy, this scapegoat. I could always blame it on the situation. I knew people would say, oh, well, you know how her husband drinks. And you took that away from me. People were praising him. 30 days, Charlie, hang in there. You know, 60 days, way to go. And they weren't praising me. They were hinting rather broadly that I could use some help. And nobody had ever done that to me in my life. So I began to accept that it's a good thing I'm responsible for my own behavior, because that means I can choose it and I can change it. If you were responsible for it, I would really be trapped, because I can't change you. I learned to respond rather than react. I didn't know that I was in emotional slavery, but I was. I didn't realize that, well, when Charles got angry, I got angry. When he got depressed, I got depressed. I thought that meant we were close. It's as if I waked up every morning and said to him, good morning, how do I feel today? Because it was entirely up to him. And you all said to me, hey, you can take your sails out of his wind. And neither he nor anyone else need determine the direction in which you go. So I began to risk being the person I am. Now, I have to, when I say that, here again I had a sponsor saying, yes, be who you are, but within the bounds of love and courtesy. I cannot ride roughshod over you and then say, oh, that's just who I am. You know, you get a Charles Manson when you do that. But within the bounds of love and courtesy, to quit being phony and to be the person I am. Now, the price for that is high. It cost me a marriage. But I'm convinced that being phony costs even more. You told me that God was a source and people were the channels, and it was all right for me to love the channels. But they might change and God would not. That was a freedom too, because I tend toward hero worship. You know, the people I love can do no wrong, or if they did, they had a good reason. That's the way I feel. And it's all right if I love the channels. I did not learn this program all at once, and I certainly don't have it all yet. I learned it, as I told you, slowly and painfully, and tears and sweat and blood. But what I have of it today is a treasure beyond price. I know that recovery is progressive too. And I had to give myself permission to have relapses. I might as well, because I have them. My favorite story of a relapse happened, oh, I don't know, in the mid-80s. I'd been visiting my son in Dallas. I have had several kinds of arthritis since childhood, and I have one knee in particular that isn't trustworthy. We started down the long flight of stairs outside his condo, and my knee gave way and I fell. It was a very bad fall. I was unconscious. He called paramedics, who brought an ambulance, took me to the emergency room of the hospital. I don't remember any of that. I remember coming to as they were putting me on the gurney in the emergency room. And the emergency room nurse was saying to me, now just lay back and take deep breaths. I was coming out of total oblivion, but I said, honey, that's lie back. I will lie back and take deep breaths. I passed out again, but when I came to, I could not shut up. I said, you see, dear, you say it so many times every day, you really must learn to say it correctly. Well, my son had put his hand over his eyes. He said, she doesn't do this to total strangers usually. Really, she doesn't. Fortunately, the nurse thought it was funny. But I tell you to say that let my defenses get down And I am, by golly, going to straighten out the world. And that is a real symptom of untreated Al-Anonism. Of course I talk the talk better than I walk the walk. Of course I do. And I walk the walk better than I feel the feeling, but I'm still the best Blanche that I have ever had. And listen, when I'm hitting a new challenge or a new situation, I am just as scared as you are after 1 year in the program, or 5 or 10. It's still new to me. And I need a hand to hold while I look around corners. And I have never yet reached out that one of your hands wasn't there. There are days when I think, what program? You know, God who? And I always call one of you, and you will tell me what program and God who. Usually in words that I have used with you. I wish you wouldn't do that. You know, well, what you've told me is. I try very hard not to be a teacher when I'm sharing my Al-Anon, but let me teach you one thing, one quick thing. I know the words to say. When I am in difficulty and when my heart is breaking, I know what to say to myself. But I need to hear you say it, because when you say it, underneath the words, I hear you saying, I love you, you matter to me, I care about you. And I don't hear that when I say it to myself. And so I think we should never feel bad when we're telling someone something we know he already knows. What he needs maybe are not those words, but the fact that we care enough to say them. I've got to talk about my children for a few minutes. Would you lock the doors so no one can leave? They're fun today, I think. Thank you. And I mean literally, thank you. Both my children have been married and divorced. My daughter is a journalist. She's political editor for the St. Petersburg Times in St. Petersburg, Florida. She is extremely successful, makes a great deal of money, and I think, of course, does brilliant work. Last January, she was one of only 6 journalists in the whole United States to be selected for a fellowship for Asian studies. And she spent 10 weeks with some other journalists traveling through Asia and trying to learn something about this coming economic giant that we're going to have there. My son is a commercial photographer in Dallas, and he too is an achiever. That's what we do best. You know, we do things. I have their permission to say to you that I would trade 20 points of their IQ for the ability to sustain intimate relationships. But they never saw that modeled in front of them, and they did see achieving. So that's what they do. He has won 2 Clios, which is the highest award you can win in advertising. There's an awards banquet in New York and a ceremony and little gold figures and the whole bit. These kids have never done any drugs or drinking. I have reared 2 quintessential caretakers. I couldn't have lain awake nights and done it better. I have these 2 classic enablers. My daughter says if you put her down in a room full of 1,000 men dressed just alike and one of them is dysfunctional, she will find him, you know? You know, why not? Her mother always did. But I cannot let you think that they grew up scot-free. They have had every problem that children have who grow up in alcoholism. They have had particular problems with depression. You told me that there are ebbs and flows in all relationships, okay? Friends, parent, child, husband, wife, lovers. And I don't panic so much now when a relationship I value sort of ebbs for a while. But 5 years ago, my son, who has always been my loving and attentive child, decided he would do better in his own life if he had no relationship with anyone in his family anymore. He asked me not to write or call or visit, and he would not either. I thought it would kill me, but it's amazing what the human psyche can endure. What we do with pain like that is we get it to a live-withable level, okay? And most of the time, that's where it stays, and then every now and then I take a day off and grieve for him. If you run out of things to pray about, I'd appreciate your praying about this relationship. You know, if he drank, I'd know what to tell him. I also need to tell you that Charles and I lost our marriage in 1980 for a variety of reasons that I don't go into in a microphone. You had said to me all along, marriage is made in sickness. loneliness do not always survive help. And I didn't want to hear you, and I didn't want to think it applied to me. Because people who love us care, I always say, no, he didn't leave me for another woman. I would have killed them both, and you'd have a different speaker this afternoon. No, I didn't throw him out for another man. No, he did not resume drinking. He would have had 24 years sobriety. I hadn't planned to cry. In July of 1988, but he died in April of that year. He died of lung cancer, still smoking 4 packs a day. I was absolutely astonished at the depth and intensity of my grief, because we had been apart some years at that time. But the pain was intense. But back to the divorce, okay? Our recovery truly had taken us down different roads and in different directions. And something toxic seemed to happen when we related to each other that didn't happen when we related to other people. And we had to accept the end of a marriage that was sick beyond healing and that had been damaged beyond repair. You told me suffering should not be wasted, that I mustn't back God into a corner, shake my finger in his face and say, why me? I mean, after all, why not me, huh? But instead, I should ask him, what am I supposed to understand? And so that's what I have been asking since then, and not all the answers are in yet. But I've understood a few things. One is that God and I are enough. Because I love learning, I began to investigate graduate schools. See, if you love teaching, you do a lot of counseling. And I thought I'd better get a piece of paper that said I could. And of course, you had told me that I deserved the best, so I picked out the longest, hardest master's program in psychology that's in Texas. It was at the University of Texas in Austin. It was 54 hours, and the thesis, that's 3 years. I was 50 years old. I said to my children, 3 years? Do you know how old I'll be in 3 years if I go get a master's degree? And my son said, how old will you be in 3 years if you don't? Well, no one had explained it to me that way, so I pulled up roots. And I left my comfort zone and sold my house. And you would have laughed to see me in graduate school. I kept wanting to teach the class. I kept wanting to say, honey, what their professor meant was. And I wanted to correct their grammar, but I don't do that when I'm conscious. And I did get this degree in psychology, this master's, in 1985. I worked part-time at our community college as a counselor and then went to the little country school that I told you about. I stayed on at the community college for 5 more years, teaching 1 class a week. It might interest you to know it was in human sexuality. Now, a sex class has to be taught by a counselor, but it was fun being interviewed for it. I mean, how does anyone ascertain that you're qualified to teach a sex class? They can't ask that you major in it in college, although you and I know people who tried. I think I got the job when they finally said to me, when you were growing up in your family of origin, how did you learn about sex? And I had a fantastically enlightened mother anyway. But I had an aunt who's the matriarch of our family. And she used to say to my mother, when it's time to tell Blanche Marie the facts of life, let me do it. She said, you'll make it sound entirely too exciting. Well, my mother taught me, thank you very much. One thing about a sex class, unlike the students in my English classes, these kids never once said, what are we learning this for? We'll never use this. Never once. Change is hard for me. Is it for you? I'm sure it's not. No one in here has trouble changing. But I've made a few changes. The first one was switching from teaching to counseling, and to tell you that I had trouble doing that, the first week on my new job, a mother called, and she had a first-grade son who was having trouble on the school bus. Would I see what it was all about? Called him into my office, darling little boy. And I said, honey, what's happening on the bus? Well, he said, those kids pester me. And I said, what do you do? Well, I don't say dirty words. I said, well, I'm very glad. What do you do? He reached over and got my tablet, very laboriously, tongue between the teeth, you know. He wrote H-S-I-T. He said, I wrote that down. I said, uh-huh, then what? Well, I showed it to them. I said, yes. And he said, well, they couldn't read it. Well, I was a fire horse hearing the bell. I said, darling, you didn't spell it right. No wonder they couldn't read it. Look, here's how you spell it. crossing the T before I thought, I don't think this is why they hired me. I don't believe it's in my job specifications that I teach obscenities to six-year-olds. But you don't wave a misspelled word in front of an English teacher. I've always hoped when he got home that day, nobody said, what did you learn in school today? And I've made some other changes. I was very happy living alone, and I was alone for 11 years. See, I went from mother and daddy to a college dormitory to mother and daddy to a husband. And I had never lived alone, and I didn't know I would like it. But I really did. And I need to tell you that the man I married eventually there also liked living alone. Something for you to think about. Maybe happy men and women make better husbands and wives, you suppose? Because we were both just doing fine by ourselves. I have to say this carefully. I am not young and I have never been beautiful, but I love men, and there always been men who are kind enough to care for me. And I had some relationships in those 11 years that I wouldn't have missed, you know. I just wouldn't have missed them. But I've been hanging out with Bob Miller for a while, the last few years. And we talked about marriage about once a year, but whoever brought it up, we depended on the other one to say, oh, well, things are fine the way they are. You know, we don't need to do that. And in October of 1991, I was getting ready to go talk in Tulsa. We were talking on the phone. And he was about to have his 25th AA birthday. And I said, now that's just 5 weeks away. I think we ought to do something really special. What should we do? And he said, well, I was thinking of getting married. Well, now it wasn't his turn. You know, I was just dumbfounded. I almost said, to whom? But he said, I've talked to my sponsor, to my lawyer, my accountant, and all three of my children, and they think it's a good idea. Now, is that a romantic proposal or what? How could you have turned down one like that? I said, well, let me talk to a few people too. And when I did, I said, okay, let's do it. If I were 20 years old, you'd have sworn I was pregnant. That was the most hurried up wedding you have ever seen. I grew up Southern Baptist. Bob is an ardent Episcopalian. I've always found Episcopalian services to be a little aerobic. You know, stand, sit, kneel, stand, sit, kneel, stand. And I was clumsy and awkward, but because he had a church and a minister, and I did not, we were married in his church. I said to his minister in the planning stages, it's a little neighborhood church. And I said, how many people does your church seat? And he said, 122 Episcopalians or 140 Baptists. I walked right into it. I said, why more Baptists? And he said, they're narrower. There were people who suggested that we might have them play Amazing Grace as we walked down the aisle in view of our ages, but we didn't do that. We were married in December of 1991, and in February, we bought a house that's absolutely wonderful. It has red carpets and 20-foot ceilings, and if you're there, you must come see us. And in March, Bob became ill. I knew that he carried the virus for hepatitis B, and periodically it had flared up. And I even knew because he had told me that eventually it would kill him. But I thought that was years down the road. And this time he didn't snap back from the flare-up. And after a couple of months, the doctors told us that he is not going to get well. He has some days that aren't as bad as others. We have a hospital bed in the bedroom, and we have a wheelchair and a walker. We have a visiting nurse. I'm trying hard to make sure that he is as happy as he can be, knowing full well that that's not really up to me. His sponsor says, Blanche, don't try to give him a perfect life for as long as he has. Try to give him a normal one. And so I hope that's what I do. I don't have to tell you that it took an agonizing decision for me to decide to come on and do what I do for Al-Anon. I cannot leave him alone, and I don't like leaving him. But he and I discussed it at great length, and we agreed that I'd better go on and do what I can do for Al-Anon, because he can no longer do what he did for AA. Death is not imminent. We figure we have a year or two yet. Some days I wish it were sooner than that. Can you understand that? Once again, I'm watching someone I love
die.
And it is agonizing. But you know what? Like my mother, he will be all right. I'm going to close with an Al-Anon promise. If you read our literature, you'd know about it, but some of you don't. So in case you've missed this, we have a promise. It says, today, this very moment is all you're sure of, and that flashing instant has gone to join the past even before you're aware of it. With this dizzy spin of time, the only safe way to make each moment count is to make your Al-Anon responses habitual. You can't go wrong following Al-Anon's teachings. With these teachings, there's no regret for yesterday, there's guidance for today, and there's hope for tomorrow. So that's the promise with which I leave you on the 10th anniversary of this Cajun Country Conference. I can promise you in Al-Anon that there's no regret for yesterday, and there's guidance for today, and especially there's hope for tomorrow.
How wonderful. When I heard Blanche